is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of every AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meeting. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you have learned here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening. My name is Sophie, and I am an alcoholic. Hi. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers and our main speaker. Our first 10-minute speaker is Fran R.
Hi everyone, I'm Fran, I'm an alcoholic. Thanks Dave for asking me to speak. My sobriety date's October 29th, 1995. Oh wow, we have a really vibrant class, don't we? let me tell you a little bit about what it's like, what it was like, what happened and what it's like now. What happened was I grew up in the Valley, youngest of 7 kids, big family. We were taught to stand up straight, speak well, look people in the eye, and have a firm handshake, and always keep up appearances. We always matched at church. We always looked great, and there was a lot of beatings and then joking and laughter and tears and pain. And my parents had great cocktail parties. So that was kind of a little picture. And we had a swimming pool and some molestation, but it was minor. So going up, you know, people say usually there's fun and then fun with problems. Mine was sort of fun with problems to start. And I'll tell you, like when I was 16, I missed the entire Missing Persons concert in my brand new checkered Vans and my brand new red miniskirt because I was throwing up in the bathroom at the Roxy Theater because I was so wasted. And I made a vow that night that I would never smoke pot after drinking. I was to break that vow 2 years later when I pooped my pants after a Sadie Hawkins blind date dance. So that was me at 18. I didn't get sober till I was 30. So there was a lot of drinking. I found out later that stimulants are much better. You don't throw up and get the spins. So I embellished my drinking. It was always drinking. I love the bars. I was a bartender for 9 years. It took me 6.5 years to graduate college. After I graduated with that jazz performance degree, I ran straight to the temp agency and answered phones and did data entry. And that was how I paid my rent, and then I bartended at night so I could drink in the bars and have enough money to drink in the bars. And I knew, and after a DUI in 89, I said, okay, I really have to button down. And I didn't. I think I hunkered down for a while, got to finish my degree in 1990, and then I think in 95, after just failing at so many different temp jobs, I thought, San Jose's the problem. I had moved up to San Jose with my parents in high school. And so my girlfriend and I got a U-Haul and her car, and we drove to Hollywood. And we got an apartment in Hollywood, and I tried to make that magic happen in the bars where I knew everybody and I knew the bartender and I could stay after hours, and it didn't really happen. I was lonely. My roommate was still working in San Jose. And so one day my sister said she was so tired of me flaking, she said she couldn't be around me anymore. And I decided to call Alcoholics Anonymous. Now when I called them, there was this nice genteel voice, "Are you new to Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I was so sensitive that I knew I would cry if I said yes. So I said, "Oh no, I've been to AA before," because I had been ordered to go to AA from my DUI prior. So I want to welcome the newcomers, by the way. I hope you can hear something that you connect with. So then I proceeded to go to some meetings in Hollywood. I didn't really connect. I knew I had to get a sponsor. And then I went to 26 and Broadway because I worked by there. And this girl was speaking. And I met her at the break. And I was so excited that she spoke to me because she had 7.5 months. And I thought she was like a rock star. She was the 10-minute speaker, and she gave me her number, and she told me to call her, and I called her that Saturday, and she spoke to me for 1.5 hours, and nobody had ever spoken to me for 1.5 hours. No girl had ever spoken to me for 1.5 hours while she was at her boyfriend's, and I just felt connected, and I felt that there was a chance, and there were people there. There were young people there. I was 30 back then. I was young at one point, you guys. And I started going to meetings, and then I met my sponsor at the next place, 4th and Wilshire, and she brought me to Pacific Group. I came to Pacific Group when I had 18 days of sobriety, and I got commitments, and I went to the yard, and it was so much fun, and I would sit there and smoke cigarettes and play volleyball, and I had played volleyball in high school, so I felt like I belonged because I knew how to play volleyball, and got pretty competitive sometimes. And I met a lot of people, and going up and down and shaking hands and going to watches at night and going to meetings and having commitments. I get to Saturday night at 6 p.m. I leave the yard at 2, go home, drive to Hollywood, and like be wired because I'd been drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes all day. And then I would come back and go to the meeting and then go out for fellowship. I mean, I did a lot, and then I was working too. Working was really hard. I got fired after 4 months in sobriety, and I thought all my problems would go away when I was magically sober, but I was still a jerk, and I was still entitled, and I did a mini inventory. My sponsor had me do a mini job inventory, and I realized what a bad employee I was, and I realized that I had to be a worker among workers and be of service and show up late, and I started getting better and better jobs and staying at those jobs. I met my husband in AA. We got married. We had this great wedding. We started struggling to get pregnant. And then he started using after we had the babies. We're blessed with twins. And, you know, if you're new, this is a trip. Sobriety, life is a trip. And if you think that it's not fun since you stopped drinking, it's a hell of a ride, and I can test that. If you stay sober, you will have all the excitement in your life. Like a husband who keeps going out, kids who are crazy, and soccer moms who are bitches, and then your daughter, you know, turns 14 and then becomes suicidal, and you have to send her away to camp it's not really camp. They called it the ranch, but she started killing herself, trying to kill herself, and we had to ship her away because I wanted to keep her alive, and it was horrible, and she was in a coma one of the times, and we sent her to rehabs, IOPs, partials. We finally sent her away to Utah. Well, twice we sent her to Utah, because after this bougie rehab, I said, they wanted to send her to Wilderness. I'm like, no, she just needs to go to Pacific Group. So that's all she needs. And she came back, and she was gung-ho. And it was like 2 weeks. And then, you know, she started, "I'm not going tonight. I'm going to go to Young People's." I knew that was the beginning of the end. So no offense to anybody who's in Ikupath. I love you guys. You do a lot. But it wasn't for her. Everybody was below her pay grade. She needed a lot of help, a lot of professionals. She has mental illness, and thank God She's in college now. She graduated high school, and she and her twin sister, who also suffered from anorexia at the same time, is in college. They both went to college, and they're thriving. And I don't know how the hell it happened, but I stayed sober through the whole thing. And their younger sister now is thriving because she doesn't have all this chaos. I mean, you guys, we were rolling on the floor, and I was screaming. I started meditating. My sponsor, I was scared to death. She was going to tell me to go to more meetings, and I just didn't have the bandwidth, you guys. I didn't. I was already going to four meetings and going to therapy and group therapy and family therapy and all this stuff. And she said, I want you to meditate for an hour every day. And I'm like, what? I had never really grasped the 11th step, but I finally got it. I laid on my back, and I would meditate with guided meditation, and I would sob, but then I started sleeping at night. I stopped crying, yelling. You know the yelling, crying that you do? Any of you have kids, you probably know what I'm talking about. And they'd be like, what's wrong with you? And I thought that they would wonder, you know, run to me and embrace me and say, I'm sorry, how can I be better? But they never did that. So my life is tranquil now. I have serenity now. I stayed sober through all of that. If you're new, and I've always wanted to say this, and I swore I was going to say it tonight, start using eye cream at 25. Even the men, please. It really helps. And use your ring finger. Remember to laugh. It really helps. When I was new and I heard these speakers and I laughed my butt off, it really, really helps. And I want to thank Pacific Group from the bottom of my heart. You guys are my life. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Eddie S.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. My name is Eddie. I'm an alcoholic. Friend, that's a great story. I just want to listen to her all night. I have a lot in common with her. I do moisturize. I've been moisturizing since I was 25. I took the glasses off so you could see that. And I did not poop myself. And there may or may not have been some molestation in my family. I don't know. Who knows? But what a great, I mean, the most exciting thing that's happened to me in the last 3 weeks is I adopted Hannah. Hannah moved in. So that's fun, right? I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous live and in person with all of you because I feel safe here. I always have. I was talking to my friend Leslie over the weekend, and we just were going on and on about how much it means to us to be here. I love Zoom. Hi, Zoom. It's good to see you, too. I loved it for what it did for us when we were out, all locked up, but my gosh, when you come in here and you see the faces and you get a chance to see people, it really does make a huge difference. It does for me anyway. I need Alcoholics Anonymous. I need meetings. I need you guys. I had a day today, it didn't start off that great. I woke up angry and resentful and ready to, thank you. Woke up just ready to, knock it out with my business partner. Poor Cindy asked me how I was doing earlier. I just kind of let her, I just vomited my emotions and, into the conversation about the day. But it was a crazy day and it got better and it got better. And I knew I was coming here and I was going to be in this room. And it just kept getting better and better. And I don't know, I just like being here. I was born and raised in Yorba Linda, California, land of gracious living behind the orange curtain. It was boring. It was boring. My father was a probation officer. My mother worked for a company called Autonetics, and they were involved in, helping put the men on the moon, and it became Rockwell International. And They, you know, growing up was you know, it was kind of typical. It wasn't a lot of people out there. We had a lot of horses. There was, you know, trails everywhere. And then there was school, and school was fine. I had a lot of friends everywhere. I liked having a lot of friends in different places just to make sure that everyone still liked me. My first addiction, I think, was your approval of me. That was really, really important for me, and I went out of my way to make sure that I had friends all over the place. And that was, and usually I did that with a, you know, with a sense of humor. I tried to keep everybody laughing and everybody entertained. That was what I, you know, that was like my defense mechanism. And what happened was, you know, you get older, and we had friends with, I was friends with the kid down the street, and our families used to take family vacations together. And at 13 years old, we decided that it was time to start drinking and start smoking. I don't know why we decided that was the time to do it, but we decided, you know, we're gonna be men, and we're gonna smoke, and we're gonna drink. And so we went to, it was a family vacation, and we went to this party up in Redding, California. And there was about 400 people at this party, and we broke into the main house and broke into the wet bar, and well, broke in. It was open. It's more exciting if I say broke in, though, right? No, we just walked in. We walked in, and the bar was open, so we poured some shots, and my first, out of the gate, it was three shots. I don't know why I remember exactly what it was. It was three shots of bourbon, 3 7-7s, 2 gin tonics, and a beer. I don't know why I count. Thank you. I felt good about that. You know, that was out of the gate. And I think why I did it so fast is because it didn't happen quick enough for me. I used to watch the adults. I used to watch how the adults, you know, they were having a good time. My family, my dad has a very serious relationship with alcohol. You know, whether or not he's an alcoholic, that's for him to say. But he does, you know, he does enjoy a drink. And so do our family friends. And I think I drank as fast as I did because it didn't happen as quickly as I thought it was going to happen. Clearly, I overshot the mark. I probably didn't need that beer. I probably didn't need the third, you know, the second gin and tonic. I probably didn't. But there was a time in there when I felt like $1 million. I felt really good. I got up on stage. There was this big party. There was a band. The band was taking a break, and I got up there, and I just started entertaining the crowd, you know, singing some dumb songs. I don't remember much of it. I remember a lot of it. I've never been afforded the privilege of blackouts. I mean, Johnny said that before, and that's been kind of my story too. As a matter of fact, I thought I was different until I heard Johnny say that, and it made me feel like, oh yeah, I should be here. But anyway, I remember entertaining the crowds, and then I just kind of passed out on a welding wagon, and just got sick all night. And I think the parents were kind of like, they kind of signed off on it. They didn't really care because they knew that I was going to be really sick and that I probably wouldn't do it again. But I had a feeling that I might do it again because I enjoyed it. There was a time in there, just before like the getting sick part, where I just felt like I landed. I could breathe for the first time in a long time. I could take a breath. And I didn't care what you thought about me. I didn't care what... I didn't care about anything. I just felt so good. It was my sponsor says it's being there. My sponsor is Charlie. I love him to death. But he talks about, you know, I was there. I was in that spot, you know, that sweet spot. So I knew I was going to try that again. Although it's really hard to get, you know, alcohol when you're growing up. You know, at 13 years old. So I didn't do a lot of drinking through high school, or I'm sorry, in junior high. But once I got into high school, I hung out with the older kids, and we used to drink on the weekends. And during the week, because I was trying to stay functional, I tried everything else. I identify as an alcoholic, but you know, I had a lot of, you know, alcohol was the love of my life. I do have a lot of friends with benefits, though, such as cocaine, marijuana, pills, anything to make me not connect, you know, or to not feel. Drinking got more and more prevalent. The weekends were great. We used to do a lot of frat parties. I had a girlfriend at the time. It's true. I had a girlfriend. That's not funny. I had a girlfriend at the time. She went to the frat parties a lot, and that was awesome because there was like keggers up there at Cal State Fullerton is where we hung out, and I'd plant myself on top of that keg and I was pouring them for everybody, and I loved it because I had the tap, man. I was in control, and I used to get really freaked out when that keg ran down. I have a real problem with supply. I need to know the supply chain is always going to be there. I just need to know that it's going to be there. Anyway, things got dicey. I barely graduated high school. I got through it. My dad and mom were going through a divorce. I was living with my dad, and things just went downhill pretty quick. I left home when I was 18 years old. My uncle invited me up there to work for him at his job. He owned a gold refinery. I went up there and I worked for him. And my uncle Johnny was a daily drinker, and I got to drink with him. And I think that's when I started drinking on a daily basis. And it was good. It was really good. He would crack those Bud Heavies at about noon, and it was on. And I just remember just getting through the day, just feeling good. And that's when it was working, and things were okay until I started wrecking cars, until I stopped opening mail, until I stopped doing all the things that I'm supposed to do as an adult. I ended up not showing up to work. I couldn't get to work anymore. I got to the point where alcohol had completely taken over my life. I wrecked my last car up there, and I moved back down to Southern California, and that's where things just kind of like just went to hell. And I went to tried to get a job, couldn't hold a job. I was waiting tables at this restaurant in Anaheim Hills, just spilling trays all the time. I was always ordering cocktails on your tabs. I mean, that was like kind of what I did. I always kept a nice beverage over at the waiter station, and when you drop a bunch of trays, they let you go. So I lost my job, and I spent the better part of a month in a room after going to jail a couple times for getting pulled over and on bench warrants that I just didn't take care of. Things got really dark really, really fast, and I was 20. I just turned 23. And spent the better part of a month in a room, in my room, on window patrol, just paranoid, freaking out, drinking every day. I had no money. I had nothing left. I was about ready to be thrown on the streets. I didn't really care much about myself. I liked bars. I was drinking in the bars, and I didn't really care who I was with or what you did to me while we were hanging out. I didn't really care about myself or my self-respect or my body or anything like that. And what happened was I spent a month in my room, and I got really, really dark. And, you know, we talk about I was dead. I was dead two out of three. I believe we die three ways, spiritually, emotionally, and physically. And I was dead two out of three. I didn't want to be here anymore. And I went to bed and I said a prayer that night. After I had a moment of clarity, I saw myself for what I was. And I said a prayer, and it was something like, please don't ever let me feel this dependent on something again. And I hadn't prayed in a long time. I didn't believe in it at all. And I woke up the next morning, and I found out that I was able to get into treatment. And what I did was I came to meetings, and I did the things that you taught me to do. And I got I started going to a meeting down in Laguna Beach, a South Coast Speakers meeting in Laguna Beach, where a lot of you came down and shared your experience, strength, and hope with me. And I'm forever grateful that you guys made that drive down that 405. I know it's a long haul, but you guys came down there and you shared with me, and I listened. And I'm so grateful to be a part of this group. I'm grateful to be sober. And that's it. Happy birthday, Laura, and happy birthday, Cal.
Our main speaker tonight is Gabe B. Gabe, alcoholic. All right. Well, I, of course, the night I get to speak, we steal 5 minutes from my time with the long form. I'm very honored to be here. I'm very honored to be here. There is one good trait every good speaker has, is one who can end on time or early. So I'll try to give you the latter of that tonight. I had a perfect day today. I woke up, slept in, woke up, worked a little bit, hopped in the sauna, sat in the ice bath and meditated and picked up a newcomer, one who's been struggling in and out of this group for a long time. And he could really use our kindness right now. He could really use our kindness. I gave him a couch commitment a couple nights ago, and he wanted to leave and go get drunk, and I told him, I'll hold your stuff as long as you sit here and pray with me for 20 minutes. And that's what we did. And it was heartbreaking.
21 minutes went by and he was out the door. And just said, I want to drink myself to death. And I don't know what separates me from him. You know, he's attended more meetings than me, probably prayed more, probably called more men in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I get to be here, you know. And I remember being, before I got sober, I came to this group for a little while. And when we were at the synagogue, I'd sit next to the piano right up here in the front. And I'd be in a little wheelchair. And I would actually cry, like watching people take one-year cakes, because I thought it was unobtainable. I go, you know, it's just not for me. Taking those cakes is not for me. And if you're new tonight, you know, I want to tell you one thing. I'm 29 years old, and I've been using face cream for 4 years. And I don't look like Eddie, but it's doing wonders for me. And, you know, I in all seriousness, you know, I do want to tell you, this is probably the most important room in the world that you can be in. You know, I just got to hear, you know, Fran and Eddie talk about, you know, all these old timers that come before me, and I just get to fall in line. I don't have to figure out anything. I just get to fall in line. And I've had some sponsees, you know, who have a couple years sober, who kind of just like stop doing the group, and now they go to meetings where they have the most time, you know, and they don't have a lot of time. And I'm grateful I get to just follow along, you know, and I get to see people like Aaron. I haven't seen Aaron in forever, man, and I know he's going through some hard stuff, and I got to see Fran got up here and told a joke and see him laugh. I just got to see him laugh, you know, and that's the program. You know, we just get to just hold each other together and keep walking through. So the important part, me, I grew up in Seattle, and I love drinking. I love thinking about myself. I love just planning out what other people are going to think about me. That's a big pastime of mine. And my wife, I'll give her credit for this one time. Then I'm stealing it from her. You know, she always shares about being in the third grade, right? And this resonated so deeply with me. If you don't resonate with the way that I drank or used, try to resonate with the feelings, right? Of speakers in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's really that's the language of the heart that I first touched. That first touched me. And you know, Carl, she was in the third grade, just like myself, and we would pass along. You know, we'd be reading a certain book, and I would see that I'm probably fourth or fifth up, and each kid reads one paragraph. So I count 4 to 5 paragraphs down, and in preparation, I read that paragraph about 5 to 6, 7 times. Because when it comes to me, I'm going to blow everyone in the room socks off. They're going to say, wow, what a freaking good reader that kid is, you know. They're talking about it at our high school reunion, you know. And that's how I went around every day of every hour of every situation I was in, you know. And I remember I only shared this one time a long time ago, but I was 13 years old. I was getting in a lot of trouble in school. And my mom, you know, she's this holistic hippie. She burned bras and marched with Martin Luther King. Like, she's like as big of a hippie as you can imagine. And she was like, well, maybe my son is just, he's stressed out. And so we were rather poor growing up. And so this was a big deal. She paid for me to go get a massage. And I said, okay, I'll go try this massage. Now I'm 13, that bravado is starting to take over. And so I walked into that masseuse's room and she said, you know, take your shirt off and I'll be back. And so, you know, I took my shirt off and I flexed as hard as I could for the next hour. And the entire time she's working on me, she goes, Gabe, you know, you can relax. And I go, I'm not even flexing, miss. And my traps were about as hard as steel, right? And she told me 30 times over the next hour, and this wasn't like some hot chick, this was like some old hag, and I still was like, she's going to leave here thinking I'm the man. And that's just my MO. I'm just, my life revolves around what other people think of me. But thank God I found alcohol. And that substance just fixed everything for me, you know. I no longer was so concerned about having to do all of these things and live my life a certain way so that you thought I was cool. I just knew, right? And you know, there's a lot of old timers in here. My sponsee says it best. You guys have your Quaaludes and Led Zeppelin, and my generation has Four Locos and Xbox. Man, them Four Locos. I just get 2 Four Locos in me. I wake up Tuesday, and then my friend tells me about all the good times we had. And it just fixes everything. The way I felt, you know, I just know I'm the man. And I start drinking at an early age. I was 9. I had a shot of Everclear. That's a long, boring story. At 12, I had 3 bottles of Riesling wine between my best friend at the time and myself, Terrell Crossan. All my friends that I grew up with are either in AA or need to be or dead. And you know, we had, I don't know if you've ever been 12 years old drinking Riesling wine, but it tastes like piss. And my beverage of choice at 12 was Dr. Pepper, so I mixed the two, and did not help. But I got it down, and the next thing I knew, I woke up with regurgitated Arco hot dog on the floor, and I still had an empty bottle of Riesling wine in my hand. I drank it so fast, I didn't even remember feeling drunk, and I heard my dad coming down the stairs. I threw it underneath the couch and just continued on. I blamed the puke on the dog, and and, you know, I continued to drink like that. I got in a lot of trouble in high school. I was always trying to be the cool kid. Got expelled everywhere that I went. Got expelled at 3 different high schools. But I was in AP, and I was in AP classes, and I was, you know, the captain of the football team and the captain of the track team. And I was just smug, and I thought I was the coolest thing ever, and had to go to the continuation schools, and eventually just dropped out, and I just started drinking as often as I could, you know, and I black out every time that I drink. And I would, if I didn't black out, I wouldn't even consider myself drinking that night. I was reading a scientific study. There's a population of about 15 to 20% of the world who's immune to hangovers. And I'm one of them. I never got a hangover. I had alcohol poisoning. I would chug 2/5. I would chug a 1/2 gallon of Smirnoff. Never got a hangover one time. And I would wake up, and I'd have 3 water bottles next to my bed. I'd drink all 3 of them and wouldn't have to piss for like 3 days. I just like would soak it up. I'd be so dehydrated. And I loved going to house parties. Oh, like I know a lot of people like drinking in bars and, you know, alleys here, and I just loved drinking at house parties. And I would drink a little bit in my room, you know, waiting for my buddy to pick me up, because I didn't start driving until I was like 2 years sober. I didn't have a driver's license, a car. I was about a year sober. I was a bum. And so I loved just drinking in my room. My buddy picks me up. I'm already, you know, pretty drunk. And I'm starting to go into a blackout upon arriving at the house, you know. I was at a house party every weekend. If we didn't have a place to go, we'd find an abandoned house. We'd take out the for sale sign, and we'd just invite 100 people over. And then break in the back window. And people would say, Gabe, you know, why are you in gym clothes? Because we knew the cops were coming. And we'd lace up our shoes, and we knew we had about a 20-minute party ready. And people would come in high heels and mini skirts, and we just sat by the door drinking, waiting for the cops to come. And you know, we loved going to house parties. And I'm starting, 17, I start to experience some consequences. Like I said, I'm blacking out a lot, and I was at this one house party. My buddy, he's in the living room tattooing his legs, and I always share this when I speak, man. He's tattooing his legs, the tops of his thighs, right in the living room. And I was like, man, this guy's savage, you know. And there's a police helicopter going above the house. There's, you know, 300-400 people here, and I go, man, okay. I hadn't had any tattoos at that point, and I remember I wanted to get something modest, like maybe my initials on my hand or something. And I shotgunned 2 4 Locos and found Can't Quit tatted on my chest. And big book blue letter ink, no stencil. I think he actually held it like this, like thumb up, you know, and it's still there today. If this were the Marina Center, I'd show you, but we're in the Pacific Group tonight. So I started to get more consequences every single time that I drank, and I started to get in trouble, and you know, a buddy robbed me, and I retaliated, and I got in some trouble for that, and my uncle called me. And a lot of you knew him. His name was Jerome Berkovich. The guy saved my life. He was as cranky as Ebenezer Scrooge, but he saved my life. And I'm wearing his cufflinks tonight. He passed away a few years ago. And he called me and said, Gabe, why don't you come move out to Los Angeles with me? And he was in the Pacific Group, and he had about 27 years sober at the time. And I hopped on a plane, and I was telling John Keefe earlier, you know, I landed March 18th, 2012, and I sat down. I mean, we didn't even drop my bags off. We went from LAX to Ohio Street Sunday night, and I sat down right next to Lauren Kay, and she whispered over to me. She goes, hey, are you a junkie? And I knew junkies weren't allowed here, even though I was withdrawing from heroin at the time. And I go, no. And then she went up and shot dope in the bathroom. I'm like, damn it, I missed out. And she ended up getting sober 2 weeks later, and she's coming up on 10 years now, you know. And it's just another example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like what my sponsor says, my first sponsor, Keith P., you know, just another regular old AA success story, you know. And because I like to think, oh man, if I'm the greatest thing ever, you know, but just another regular AA success story. And so I landed here in March. I didn't get sober until at the end of the year, and it was a wild ride. My uncle introduced me to a guy he was sponsoring by the name of Crackhead Harry, and God, a lot of you guys know Crackhead Harry, and Crackhead Harry introduced me to why his name is Crackhead Harry. And you know, my uncle, he tolerated Harry and I, and in the Pacific Group there's kind of like the I don't know what it's called, a sober vehicle, right? And so the person with the most time would always sit shotgun when we were driving to a meeting. And so it was Sunday night, Ohio Street, Harry's in front with 2 days, I'm in the back with zero. Monday night, Ohio Street, I'm in the front with 1 day, Harry's in the back with zero. Wednesday night, Harry's in front with 2 days, I'm in the back with zero, like for like 6 months. And he would walk out, and I would be passed out drunk on a completely deflated air mattress, and Harry's checking the blinds, right? And for 6 months, my uncle, the patience of a god, just dealt with us, you know, and just spoon-fed us AA. And then that didn't work, so it kicked us out, right? And I went down to the Midnight Mission, and then Harry, I don't know what he did, but I went down to the Mission and still wasn't done. You know, I got in an accident there, broke my leg, had a couple surgeries, started using some other stuff, overdosed there, buying alcohol at the Mission, still getting drunk. And, you know, I had a belly full of booze and a head full of AA because I had to go to 4 meetings a week with my uncle, you know. And I remember just seeing my life, just for a second, I think I felt the way that guy who spent the night in my house 2 nights ago felt, right? Where it was like, I'm just going to drink myself to death. I'm here. I got felony warrants in Seattle, felony warrants in California. I have no driver's license, no job history. I'm 19 years old. I'm in a wheelchair in a homeless shelter on Skid Row. Why try, right? Why try? I just said, well, I'm going to do this third step prayer tonight. And when it doesn't work, not if it doesn't work, when it doesn't work, I'm going to drink this last fifth of gin I had. I had $10 to my name. I had a guy go buy a fifth of gin for me for $9 that night. So I had $1 and one fifth of gin. That's the last thing I had in like a trash bag filled with clothes. And so I got on down on one knee. I had a cast up to my groin. And I kind of said a third step prayer. And no white light experience happened, right? It was just, I just said the prayer, and then I got up, and I rolled over to the closest bathroom stall. I broke the seal of the alcohol, and I poured it down the drain, right? And in our literature on page 567, it talks about the spiritual experience, because in Bill's story, in the first chapter, he shares that he had this great white light experience where it profoundly hit him suddenly, like a great wind over a mountaintop, and he never drank again, right? And I thought, well, if I'm waiting for that, right? And I guess it ain't coming, so I'm going to keep drinking, right? But that never came for me. All that happened was, in hindsight, I haven't obsessed about drinking or using since then. I can't really explain it. You know, I can't really explain it. Was it God? I don't know. That sounds corny. I never really liked giving credit to him, because I did all the footwork, right? I poured that alcohol out, and I don't think it was this day specifically. I think I had a couple days sober, but my sobriety date is November 13th, 2012. So. If you're new tonight, when people say they're a particular sober year, generally the people in that class clap. And when it's not that loud like that, it just shows how much humility we really have. 85, really loud. It's the lack of humility. So 2012, I'm getting sober, and I knew, okay, I've been going to Wednesday night for a year, and I heard the best speakers in the world. I'm often drunk, but a lot of that stuff was still sitting in and resonating with me. And I said, all right, man, I want to get out of this freaking mission. And I asked my uncle, what can I do? He said, you just go to a meeting every day, you know. So I'm on the mission van every night, going to a Pacific group meeting. Eventually, about 4 months after being there, he lets me move back in with him. And I went from a homeless shelter on Skid Row up into the Hollywood Hills rent-free. And he was so mean to me. I was packing my bags on a weekly basis, ready to go back to the mission. I kid you not, you know, and he made me pay him to drive me to the closest bus stop, and I had to take a bus from, you know, Barham all the way, you know, off the 101 all the way down to the Pacific Group in a wheelchair, three buses each way in the snow, uphill both ways, and I would just listen to like 50 Cent on my iPod and grind my teeth and just say, I can't wait for a sponsee to tell me he can't make it to a meeting, you know, and I got guys saying they can't make it to Zoom meetings today, you know, or my mom didn't upload my Uber card, you know. I kind of just, in a disgruntled manner, just grinded my teeth to 6 months of sobriety, and I hated doing AA. But it was a means of staying out of the mission, and it was a means of not being homeless. And you know, there was something... I did come to that realization that I could never be successful if I continued to drink, and that my life, I just for a moment, I kind of got to see like out here, right, from the view of the reason we have a sponsor, right? Somebody can see outside, and I just thought, like, my life is going to continuously just go down the drain. It'll never get better. It'll only get worse, right? And who knows if that would have been the case. But I wasn't trying to stick around drinking to find out. And what happened was, you know, at 6 months of sobriety, I kind of crossed this invisible line within the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, I remember it very clearly. I had upgraded to crutches now, and I was crutching my way up to Ohio Street. It was a Monday night. I was about 5 minutes late to my hour early commitment, and I was huffing and puffing. I still had my whole left leg in a cast. And I was kind of kind of running with one leg up to the meeting, and I stopped for a second, and I go, oh my God, I got a broken leg, and I'm running to an AA meeting. I'm running to an AA meeting, right? And I hate AA. I hate all y'all, and I just don't like it, you know, especially getting there early. And I feel ya. And so I go, well, I think I like the way it makes me feel. I think I like it. I know I like it the way it makes me feel. and I'm getting a little bit more self-confidence. And people are very kind here, right? And there was a woman, Jocelyn, who's in my class, and she would let me use her car to, like, go for a driver's license test, you know? And she barely knew me. I was just some 20-year-old, 19-year-old kid who wore, I shared about this the other night, like, I had really long hair, really long curly hair, and I would tie it up with a dirty shoestring. Like, not a clean one, like, I would just kind of puff it up and put a shoestring in there, and people were always kind to me, and they gave me trust, you know. I remember I bought Connor M. a pair of shoes for his 1-year birthday, and I wanted to secretly give it to him, and so I asked Kenna, I go, hey, can you put this in your car? And she gave me the keys to her Lexus, and it like took my breath away that somebody would trust me with their car keys. I remember I ran as fast as I could because I didn't want her to think I'm stealing change out of her cup holder, you know? Because anytime somebody would give me keys to their car, I'm like going through the thing, you know? And so just people were kind to me and they trusted me and I started to build a life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if there's one thing you can hear, man, it's like stick around long enough to have a sober story. Because I'd get a week and go out, AA's not working, you know. I'd get a month, go out, AA's not working, right? And I just started to build a sober life for myself, and I finally got the car, and I'm in my evangelical stage of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm sure you guys know, you know, I'm about a year sober, and I'm calling all my friends from Washington saying it's time to get sober. I got this ballin' facility in the heart of downtown LA. They have a basketball court and a chef. And I'd pick them up from LAX and drop them off at the mission. Now, I was telling the truth, but I kind of worried the truth a lot. That's been a little bit of a pattern for me. And I don't know if any of those guys stayed sober, not one of them. But I was just so jazzed on Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was living the steps in most of my affairs, and you know, I'm going to 7 meetings a week, really 10 meetings a week, the yard, like Fran was talking about. I'd get out of the yard about 1 or 2, I'd drive back to Hollywood, and I'd come back, I had to buy the soda, and so I would have to be at the meeting at like 5:30. My whole Saturday was AA every week, you know, and then do something after, go to fellowship, and my life was revolving around Alcoholics Anonymous, and living the principles in almost all of my affairs that led me to just driving down the road with Sharon and cops came and they said, sir, do you have your license and red? I wasn't even driving. She was driving and they pulled me out and I had warrants. And I just was always under the impression that if you just ignored things for long enough, they're going to go, they'll get resolved somehow. They'll just go away. That does not happen in LA County. So they took me to jail. I did like 2 weeks in jail. And I'm like peak evangelical AA phase right now. Like, and I'm just sitting there in my county blues, like, damn, I'm 15 months sober and in every drunk tank preaching AA. You guys don't have to live like this anymore. And you know, they didn't give me a panel yet, and so I said, I'm gonna go on the inside, get it the hard way. And you know, I got guys' numbers from that. You know, my bunkie, I got his number, Mike, you know. I got out a year later, haven't heard from this guy, Mike, but he had my number, I had his, you know, never talked, and I think his number was disconnected. A year later, I'm leaving the log cabin, at the log cabin, it doesn't matter. He's walking up in the Hollywood Hills, right? I'm driving home, and he has a 211. It's 9 a.m. He has a 211, bottom of the can to the sky. And I go, Mike? And he goes, Gabe? And he comes over, he hops in my car, and he finishes off his can, and he looks at me, and his eyes are watering, and he goes, Gabe, are you still sober? And I go, of course, man, I just left a meeting. Do you want to go to another one? And that weekend, I got him involved. We were going to Monterey the next day. And I got him on the bus to Monterey. And I might have asked John Clough to sponsor him. Or he got involved for about a week and then haven't heard from him since, you know. And I hope that, you know, God puts us in really weird places, you know. And I hope that You know, sometimes I can be useful. Sometimes in situations where I think, how could my life bring me to this point? This is, like, not fair. I've done everything right, right? And maybe I can be useful in situations like that, and I hope I planted the seed in that dude. And then I started listening to old-timers here, and they said, go pursue your dreams. And I go, well, look, man, you're old. I got big dreams. I got big dreams, you know. I want to go to the NFL, you know. And he goes, well, take a class at SMC. And so I took a class at SMC, and I started playing football there and started running track. And spoiler alert, I didn't make it. But, you know, it led me onto an incredible path that I could never in a million years guess how you can't connect the dots going forward, right? It's in hindsight, we look back and we go, wow, you know, like the next dot doesn't look like it's going to lead to anything for me. But I started taking classes there. I started playing football there. I started running track. I won some awards. I gave an acceptance speech for Athlete of the Year, and a guy in the crowd came up to me after and he says, hey, Gabe, I remember I just repeated AA stuff because they were like, tell us about why your coach is great. My coach sucked. And I just told him, like, I basically spoke to as if my sponsor was in the room. And I said, you know, my coach taught me to show up early and be on time. Everything I learned in the Pacific Group, I just said it out loud, right? And so this guy came up to me and he goes, hey, man, I really liked your speech. Do you want a job as a personal trainer? Right? And I was making about $12 an hour. I was working full time. I was going to school full time. I was a captain of the track team, captain of the football team, and working on my real estate degree, and just life was rough. I was so stressed. I was breaking out in hives. I'd like grind my teeth at night. And I go, wow, $60 an hour to train. Let me join. And so I signed up with this guy. And then that led to a really cool career as a personal trainer. And then that led to somebody asking me, I recently started a car and I started a staffing agency 2 years ago, and we got 30 employees. And it literally just from one old timer, I believe it was Matt Tricky. He was always the one on my head, you know, and he would say, go to school, you know, and I hated school. I dropped out of school, 0.0 GPA my freshman year. I dropped out with sophomore credits when I was 18 and a half years old. And I just listened to one small piece of advice that led to the next, that led to the next, that led to the next, you know. And when I was, you know, 22, making $12 an hour, eating top ramen, barely making it to work because I had to pay for gas with change. I had $2.22 on pump four. So, you know, like, I remember I was 2 years sober asking for that and just not understanding how I could make things work, you know. And then on top of all that, I had this wreckage with my parents and my dad. You know, they installed a deadbolt on my bedroom door when I was 13 years old, because I would keep a baseball bat in my room. And I said, when you sleep, mother effer, I'm going to bust your kneecaps out. You know, and my dad would tell me every day, I wish you would run away. I wish you would just be gone. If I had the money to send you to military school, I would in a heartbeat, you know. And my dad had good reason for saying those things to me, because I was a terrible kid. And he had knee surgery, and I remember I was selling drugs, and he turned my phone off. I was 15, and I flipped over every piece of furniture in the entire house, so he didn't have anywhere to sit. And he kind of just stood there, slumped against the wall, until my mom came home. That was one of a million stories, you know. And so I had this terrible relationship. And when we get sober, I'm sure you know what those phone calls are like. And when your sponsor's like, call your dad, call your mom, ask them how their day is. And for probably 2 years, those phone calls were, hi, okay, have a nice day, you know, and just those awkward, like, weird, you know, but I did it, right? And I left for work at like 5 a.m. to train, and my dad, he's the Oaken man, an exterminator, and he was always up. He worked like 2 a.m. to noon every day, so he was up when I would leave for work, and I just got to find interests that he had, right, rather than talking about myself. And I got to build this incredible relationship with my father and my mother. And I remember 3 years sober, I heard a speaker talk about doing a trail, a big hiking trip in the Enchanted Valley in Lake Quinault, Washington. I go, oh my goodness, I used to go camping there when I was a kid at Lake Quinault, but I had never heard of this. So I told my dad, I go, let's do this hiking trip. And it's 29 miles, and we did it in a day. And I remember we were walking up there talking about stupid stuff about mile six, and the path is so narrow, we have to stand me in front of him and him behind me, and the conversation goes quiet for a little while. And it was kind of awkward because I asked him something. I didn't respond. I looked back and just tears leaking down this guy's cheeks, you know, because, and he just mustered out of his cracked throat, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous gave me my son back, you know, and I have a great relationship with my father today. You know, we get to talk all the time, and this year, you know, Carl and I, we're going to bring my folks to Iceland, and, you know, I just am so grateful for the relationships that AA has given me back in my life. And I live a full, rich, purposeful life. And my friend always talks about, like, you know, I wasn't in the mission, like, dying of alcoholism, like, calling my uncle, like, man, Jerome, I just want to help new guys and have purpose, right? I was just like, dude, I don't want to die of alcoholism. And it's given me so much more than that. Like, I sponsor some guys, and we just have such a rich community. And every year we go up into Big Bear and have a little retreat with each other. And it's the highlight of my life. They talk about, you know, around page 150, Bill has this like sales speech about going to AA, and he's like, meeting new guys will be the highlight of your life. And I read that, and I was like, that is bull crap. That is such a lie, you know. And my life is so rich because I get to sponsor these men, you know, and it keeps me coming back because I can't tell them to be early to the meeting and I'm late, you know. And you know, I've continued to pursue my dreams. I want to live a rich life in every aspect. Cara and I, you know, we got married in May, about 7 months ago, and we got to go to Kilimanjaro and hike to the top of that mountain, and it was just like, I remember we got to the very top, our guide started vomiting terribly from altitude sickness on our ascent day. I was like, that's not good. And then we ran out of water, and then we had like one thermos left, and when we got to the top, it froze. So we were completely out of water, and I remember I was so dehydrated, I was literally hallucinating. And like, what, we were wobbly, and we finally got to the top, and I was just like, I gotta turn back, and we hit this edge, and I got to see the top of the mountain, and there's like this little sign, and both Carr and I, we were like open mouth weeping, not like tears coming down, just like open mouth weeping, and it wasn't like, oh yeah, I made it to the top of the mountain, right? Everything flashed in front of me. Like, I'm just some drunk kid who was in a homeless shelter 9 years ago, right? And how did I get from there to the top of that mountain, right? And it wasn't, you know, rigorous training and saving up my money to afford the trip, right? It was just taking the next commitment. It was making coffee at Sunday Night Ohio Street. And it was making sure I left that meeting with at least one newcomer's number, right? For 9 years. And then one insignificant action led to the next, that led to the next, that led to the next. And end of this year, I'm going to go hike Aconcagua, which is the largest mountain in South America. And just like, I get to do these little things all because I've kept AA first in my life. That's the only reason. When I was brand new and I was looking at going to school, right, it wasn't like, well, I really need to take this biology class and it's only on Wednesday nights. Oh, well, PG, never. They were pillars in my life. I always scheduled my life around my meeting schedule. And I always scheduled my school and my work around Alcoholics Anonymous. At 11 months over, I offered a job of 70 grand a year. It was just for a midway car rental, just driving their higher end fleet like Porsches and Ferraris from LA to San Diego. And I was digging ditches for my uncle, sunburned, blisters on my hand. And they said, we just need you to work 6 nights a week. And I remember telling my sponsor, I thanked him for his service, and I had a new career. But thank goodness that night I was just willing enough to stick to what had been laid out for me. You know, I remember my sponsor Tim telling me, I think I missed Wednesday for like a finals or something, and he was telling me he's been coming for 35 plus years and he's missed Wednesday night 2 times. I think that's changed with COVID a little bit. But I remember I was like, man, you know, and just we practice what we preach here, you know, and that wasn't a new novel idea that I thought of, keeping AA first. But everyone, and I really appreciated what Aaron said about emphasizing the dash in that first step, because I hadn't really made that conclusion, right? It's kind of like two parts to the first step, you know, okay, I'm powerless, but I've got my life under control. I've got this covered. And I'm so grateful that there was a path laid out for me to really show me, you know, what a manageable life looks like, you know? And it was just keeping AA first, because I sponsor a lot of guys, you know, a lot of them, they got that first part of the first step down, and a lot of other ones, they got the second part of that first step down. And unfortunately, those guys aren't here, right? Because they only got that first part or that second part, you know? And this group has spoon-fed me Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm forever grateful for it. So thanks for letting me speak.